God, the beneficent and merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. Peace and blessings upon the servant and messenger of Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Muhammad Rashid. Today we have our 14th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of the topic of production and productivity, and we'll be commenting on the prohibition of interest in Islam. I have joining me with you on the program, Dr. Jamal Battery of Fitness University. Dr. Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
At the beginning of each episode, we always take a few moments to summarize the main points touched on in the previous program. Could I ask you to quickly summarize the main points from the 13th program yesterday?
Sure. In the 13th program, we described the two different types of interest dealings that were common before Islam. And he said that one of them is clearly prohibited in Islam. The other many Jews believe also to be prohibited by analogy, and he described why. And we had also some brief discussion of the opinions, their opinions of some, you might say, those who made an error in interpretation concerning the prohibition of interest. And he indicated that some of them kept quiet or changed their minds after the other majority of Jews pointed to them the difficulty with their interpretation. So the consensus held that it is prohibited, there is no question about it. There was also some discussion of the reasons behind the prohibition of interest dealing in a few of the Islamic societies. We discussed some of the harms caused by interest dealings as it affects the characters of the individual, the nature of society, the social structures, the political process, and even in some cases causing some economic harm, and we have discussed that briefly. We made a distinction between borrowing in the sense of saying expecting interest versus partnership, which is totally different because in partnership they're sharing in profit and loss. The basic thing we try to clarify is that dealing in interest is not really an imperative. It is not a necessity to establish an economic system at all. And there are so many alternatives acceptable within Islamic legislation. This includes things like buying common stocks, mutual funds, partnerships, variety of ways of investment, which meets the needs of different people depending on the term of investment they want and the degree of risk they wish to be engaged in.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, some would argue that even though there may be other alternatives, the elimination of interest, the agreements with interest, will reduces those alternatives by one. How would you respond to somebody who took that particular view?
Interesting enough, I've had a discussion with one of my colleagues, an economist at St. Mary's University, on this exact issue. Two of them, in fact, were discussing the issue, one of the economists. And his basic argument is that when we speak in economics about maximization, we say you have to explore all possible alternatives and then, of course, determine what maximizes your benefit. And he said that if an individual, for example, in his own thinking, feels that dealing with interest maximizes his benefits, then by prohibiting, by somebody stepping in and saying there is no interest, you're really arbitrarily restricting those alternatives, and as such, you're not really achieving maximization. To which my response was this, that for, first of all, in a purely economic system, Islamic system, it is not a matter of some dictator or ruler or somebody saying, no, nobody is going to deal in interest. It is a matter which is based on the teaching of God and the conviction of members of that community or society that interest dealing is contrary to Islam, it's contrary to the will of God. And if we take the individual as the judge for maximization, then individuals in that community will not consider interest to be an alternative. And as such, there is no problem with maximization. In other words, it's outside of the range of thinking by their own conviction and commitment. There is no problem here with the maximization of efficiency. And he agreed, he conceded to that particular point. But I may wish to add also one thing. While even maximization, while it looks to us as an attractive concept, let's remember that maximization is not the ideal thing in everything. For example, in teachings in the area of labor relations, union management relations, if a union maximizes its gain from management, regardless of management's ability to pay, they might cause management to go bankrupt and they would lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
If management maximizes their benefit by giving very low wages, for example, they may lose their skilled workers. And again, in the long term, they are the losers.
Yes.
In other words, what I'm saying is that maximization is not always the ideal in everything, regardless. Let's remember that, maximization is not a purely economic concept. It's not just a mathematical concept. Because maximization cannot be divorced from values and possible harms and benefits in society. A person can maximize his wealth by theft, cheating, or extortion.
Mm-hmm.
But so maximization is not something to be worshipped.
Yeah.
It has to also be considered in the light of the social benefit of society.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, another possible argument that is sometimes put forward is the question of as to why it is ethically wrong to get guaranteed interest, but at the same time it's okay to get guaranteed wage or salary, regardless of whether or not the employer you're working for suffers a profit or a loss.
Mm-hmm.
Some would argue that are these not the same kinds of things?
Well, a colleague of mine in the area of management, who seems to also to have particular interest in the concept of profit sharing, has raised this particular issue also. My answer to this is this. If you're going to say that it is ethically wrong to take interest, for example, regardless of profit or loss, why is it, as you put it, why is it not unethical also or improper for you to take a particular wage,
mm-hmm,
without knowing whether the company is going to win or lose? The answer to that question is that if you're going to pursue this line and mix between borrowing and hiring labor as a factor of production, you will result in total chaos in society. Because the same thing would apply to buying power. Why should you pay the power company, you know, at a given rate before working until you find out whether the company is making profit, and again, in view of that profit, you determine what you should pay to the power company and all other suppliers? Which, of course, doesn't make much sense, really, because, you know, you would have so many different prices depending on whether the company buying electric power is making profit or lost more profit or less profit. I think the difficulty here, aside from the fact that it's totally impractical to apply it in these particular areas, is basically the mix between two things. When you talk about investment, the money that you have is not a factor of production, as you have indicated in a previous problem. The paper money, whatever the case may be, cannot produce wealth in itself, cannot produce in itself product or service. It's only a medium, it's a measure of value.
Mm-hmm.
It is only when you buy equipment using this money, then you can start getting something more concrete in terms of production. Whereas labor is a concrete contribution to the productive process. So the two should not be mixed. When you buy labor, if you will, you're buying units of effort or labor at the going price. You're buying units of electric power at the going rate. So you don't have to say, right, I won't pay you unless I find out whether I'm making profit. You're buying, and this is the kind of risk that you're taking in business. But investment is a different thing, because you could share. There is a possibility, not much difficult really, of calculating the question of the share that you deserve because of your contribution of capital, like when you buy stocks, for example, or mutual funds. But to say that this applies to labourers, it would be very impractical to apply. In fact, I may add also one point here, that even the notion of tying labour, or the payment to labour by way of wages and salary, to profit is also possible under two circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Some not totally eliminated, really. One is the so-called sleeping partnership that we described in the previous program. that you contribute capital, I contribute labor, and then we agree that each one will take certain percent of the profit. So that's one possibility. Where my labor is not guaranteed, it's based on profit or loss. A second possibility is the scheme of profit sharing, whereby you're paid a certain minimum salary, you know, but in addition to that, you get some bonus depending on the total performance of the company or corporation. And this is something which is gaining in popularity and would help bring about some degree of justice and equity in wage payment.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in an ideal economic system, according to Islam, will there be any banking institutions?
Well, when we say that Islam, or an ideal Islamic situation, there should be no interest dealing, it does not mean that there would be no banks, at least the way you understand the various functions of banking today. But the functions themselves may change. In other words, you could still have financial institutions, but performing different functions. Let's take a few examples of what the bank is doing. When you go to the bank, you could have a safe deposit, whether you want to keep cash or gold or silver, whatever. Under an Islamic system, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just asking God as a service, institution, and you're paying certain, you know, fees for that. Secondly, if you wish to keep your money in what we call today something like current account,
yes,
you may or may not authorize the bank to use that for short-term type of projects. But in any case, you may be paying, for example, a fee, just like checking your fees or X number of cents per check, for example, written, or minimum service charge per month. Again, that would not be contrary to Islam because it's a service done to you. If you wish to invest your money in a specific project, long-term project or medium-range type of project, through the bank, in an Islamic system, a bank also could undertake that on behalf of many depositors where the money are designated for a particular project, and then they get profit or loss, depending, of course, on the performance of that project or group of projects.
Yes.
And finally, even in so-called short-term type of deposits, you could still have that under Islamic system, but not in return for any fixed interest. But with the idea that the bank would use this fund in Islamically acceptable type of projects or investments, and at the end of the year, they calculate how much income has been achieved, and they just distribute it per dollar. So again, you get your share of your investment. There are all kinds of ways of doing it. The main idea here is that banks here would not create money, if you will, hide money, because their role would be basically service or investment role, leaving the question of total monetary control to the state or to the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about consumption loans? If there's no interest being charged on these particular loans, how do you encourage people to save and to work with the money?
Well, it depends as to what are the reasons or motives behind these consumption loans. If you're talking, for example, about a person who is borrowing to meet his or her basic needs for food or clothing or housing, under an Islamic system or proper ideal Islamic society,
mm-hmm,
that person need not borrow to live. As we'll talk about later, perhaps the question of zakah or institutionalized charity would take care of this. It's a sort of social insurance, really, that no needy person would have to borrow to eat or clothe himself or herself.
Mm-hmm.
There are some consumers, however, who may wish to borrow in order to meet needs which are either emergency type of needs, which could also qualify for zakah, like people who are in a situation of disaster or unexpected loss. They could also qualify for zakah.
Yes.
Or it could be a temporary type of situation and the person is able to pay, in which case it would be only reasonable to expect that some funds, part of the zakah fund or part of the, or a portion of the fund in a bank could be allocated to be provided interest free for this basic need. If a person, however, wishes to buy something which is not really essential, and the bank, of course, will have to investigate all these applications, then it's a matter then that of agreement between the person and whoever is selling him that item to agree on, you know, how the payment is going to be made, provided, of course, there is, you know, interest involved in that. And preferably, actually, waiting until he's got the sufficient funds to be able to buy things without really having to go around and, you know, beg people for help. Actually, as in Citizen, one program in more recently, it's appropriate, ethically in Islam, not to try to overspend beyond one's own means and just depend on borrowing, whether it's interest or not. It's better to try to live within one's means. And in fact, many of the problems faced by many people, many families today, is this availability of charge cards and borrow now and pay later. This temptation leads people to spend beyond their means and suffer as a consequence of this.
Well, there would be some, I'm sure, who might suggest that this seems to be appropriate and fitting when you're talking about the situation on the individual level, but that wouldn't have application on the national level or on the state level. They ask, for example, what about public debt? How can government borrow money if the need arises if they're not permitted to get involved in interest-related kinds of situations? How would you respond to that?
Okay, maybe you can approach it also the same way we're looking at the individual, at least in terms of Mr. Dorothy. Why does the government want to borrow? Well, first of all, by way of comment, let us remember that the easy access to money to government by way of just offering bonds and whatever, people of course will be encouraged because of the interest you get. This easy access many times leads to a great deal of inefficiencies. I leave that to politicians and economists, but there are lots of questions, as you know, particularly in North America, about the inefficiencies in government expenditure, and this availability of excess funds probably might not necessarily work in favor of the taxpayers themselves. And it is, after all, the taxpayer who is going to pay for this interest. If you look into the budget of any municipal or state, provincial, or federal government, you'll find a sizable percentage of the budget simply goes to finance this, just by those interest. So it falls back on the taxpayer's shoulders in the final analysis. However, one has to be fair also in recognizing that there may be cases where it is necessary for the government to obtain funds, I'm not saying to borrow, to obtain funds in order to meet certain emergencies. Take the case of a country under attack or being invaded and they need to collect funds to defend themselves. And you know that defense budget could be quite expensive.
Yeah.
Well, the Islamic approach to this is that, first of all, through the regular zakah, or institutionalized charity, you can have funds to use for this purpose of emergency, this legitimate expenditure of the car, without necessarily having to borrow. Secondly, in Islamic law, a just government may impose additional taxes on those who are able to, not on the poor, on those who are able to, but at least injustice, not just hitting one individual or two, but I mean to have it also equitably on those who are able to, in order to meet those needs. And after all, why, in the case of emergency or war, you expect people to sacrifice their lives and you don't expect the rich to sacrifice their profits, not even their lives? It would be unreasonable. And in fact, one of the main problems, as you know, that faced the United States, for example, that is the debt incurred during the war, which continued for decades still to be paid back along with its compound interest. This is unfair because the rich, at the time of war, they became richer because, of course, the industrial complex that was in the war. So they became much richer. They get this windfall profit.
Mm-hmm.
Young people were the ones who sacrificed their lives. So why expect people to sacrifice their lives and not expect those who gain even financially out of the state of war to pay their fair share, rather than tribute it on the poor and rich alike? So this is one serious question to be raised, really. we should be. However, if there is need also for other projects, which would be needed, certain public utilities, let's say, that the government may wish to take over, again, they can invite people to, instead of lend money, to invest in those projects. Maybe the government can get some kind of support and, you know, help by way of technical information and so on. And people can still gain some profit, not interest, by their contribution to this. The question of public debt could be dealt with under Islamic system without interest. After all, under Islamic rule, which extended for hundreds of years, there was no need really to resort to interest, and it was a very prosperous economy.
Yes.
There was no problem with consumer loans, and everything was going quite smooth, to the point, as you might recall from a previous program, that at one time, the minimum would be 2.5% roughly, the minimum amount of institutionalized charity or zakat was not, did not find enough poor people to demand it, and it was sent for other humanitarian purposes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that even in the 20th century, do we?
No, indeed we don't. Well, so far in this, in the 13 programs that we've had in this series, we've been concentrating predominantly on consumption and production. I'd like to perhaps now move over to some discussion, begin some discussion of the question of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, does Islam encourage or allow for the free determination of prices in the marketplace?
Okay, the basic rule in Islamic law, in that respect, is basically the freedom of pricing. That is to let the prices be determined in the market, or in the more modern term, to let the forces of supply and demand determine the price level. The source for this kind of statement is a saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when at one time prices seemed to have been going up. So the companion came to him and he said, why don't you interfere and step in and just determine prices for us? And his reply was, Allahu huwa al-misa'ir. He says, Allah, or God, capital G, God is the one who determines prices. What he really meant by that, allegorically really, is that that there are forces, natural forces of supply and demand, which result in the determination of this crisis. But he continues, he says, I fear that I will meet God or Allah in the day of judgment with somebody complaining. In other words, I'm afraid if I say, like, you must sell at this price or that price, that somebody would come in the day of judgment and complain to God that I caused injustice or inequity by stepping in and dictating a price. This is the basic rule. But this rule, however, should not be confused to mean that under no circumstances is a just Muslim ruler eligible or allowed to determine prices or interfere in the operation of the market. Because after all, as many economists, not all specialist economists, even people like Chamberlain as early as the 30s, have indicated that the old notion suggested by Adam Smith of the so-called invisible hand keeping everything in balance or equilibrium in the economy is not really totally correct. That many times there are imbalance and demand that under the circumstances. There are cases even where the government may really take a very strong role on that, provided, again, that should be only used in absolute necessity and not in an arbitrary way, on the basis of mutual consultation and what is absolutely needed to provide for that. One interesting thing that shows from early years and their understanding of basic economic notions, a famous jurist by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah said that higher prices could be caused by one of two things. One, in modern terms, that there is more demand or that cost is going up. And if somebody forces you to sell at a given price, he might be forcing you to sell at less than cost, which is unfair. On the other hand, he said the other reason is that crisis may be growing up because somebody, somewhere, person or group, are exploiting the basic necessities of people, creating an artificially high price, in which case the interference or control would be called for.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there's another related question. We were speaking a moment ago about the basic needs of people. What happens if you have a, forgetting the price for a moment, but what happens if you have a merchant who has materials that are badly needed that he's refusing to sell? For example, we talked about food stuff earlier. Forgetting the price, can it be supposed to place them on the market? The city to sell?
Well, again, like the question of price determination, the basic rule, again, is the respect of individual freedom. I qualify that in a minute. But basically, an individual is free to sell or not to sell. Because, again, if you open the door and say, you don't have that basic freedom, well, any dictator or despot can just, impose anything on you. So the basic rule is that you're free to, to sell what you wish or withhold what you want. But the case that you mentioned here is a very serious one. Here is the case where individual freedom comes into conflict with social needs and or social interests. And the two must be done. And that's a principle that we all recognize in all laws, in various aspects. We have to balance, of course, needs. Well, in a case like that, Islam does not let people starve. And if the person fails to sell at a fair price, Islamic law would not rule out the possibility that you have to force the person to sell the basic needs for food. Actually, forcing to sell is a principle which is applied even in the most capitalist economy. Example, if you don't pay your taxes on your home,
yeah.
So you could be forced to sell to pay for this. If you have debt towards others and you fail to pay, then your property could be again be sold against your will. So the but provided, of course, that this should not be an arbitrary type of matter. It should be fair and absolutely new.
Well, I think on that note, we'll conclude for today. We want to invite you back next week when we'll continue with our discussion of distribution and social justice in Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Allah, 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 Allah,